she'll take some of the restaurant documents.
Okay, the Environment, Economic Development, Agriculture Division for Monday, March 17th, 2014 will come to order. Happy St. Patty's Day, everybody. You have a nice green coat on. I see Senator Rest. Senator Rest, we don't have a quorum yet, so what we'll do is we'll let you present the bill. I know you just are making a date change or something in your bill, so it's not. And then I think what we'll do is once we get a quorum, you won't have to be here. We'll have somebody move the bill, and we'll try and get it going on its own. And if we need to have it in some type of an omnibus bill, maybe we'll do that too. So, Senator Rest, Senate File 2205.
Mr. Chairman and members, just a little bit of background about this bill. The only thing we're changing is updating the discretionary date with regard to it, but it does deal with Courage Center, which is a facility in my district in Golden Valley. And for any number of years, it's run a program that provides competitive employment and wage opportunities to individuals with severe disabilities in integrated work settings. And as time has gone on, the definition that would have ordinarily been applied to these activities has changed. And at every point to continue their program, Courage Center has been grandfathered in. However, there was in June of 2013, Courage Center merged with Allina Health, and all of a sudden, this grandfathering permissiveness was no longer just really no longer viable, and the whole thing needs some updating, and so the grandfathering disappeared. What happened was that a legislative a rider was put on to an omnibus appropriations bill that expressly allowed the state funds to flow to the extended employment program that was determined it would be needed. The provision was added to the omnibus jobs bill. And it's the same language that you see in front of you in 2205. The work that needs to be done in this area has not yet been completed, and so we need the same fix moved out another year to allow Allina Health to continue it for the next fiscal year. The current contract with Deed ends on June 30th for 2014, and if you look on, the language is the same as from the last year's bill, and on line 2.5, it just moves it to June 30th of 2015. Everybody knows that a long-term solution with regard to these employment opportunities is needed, and not just a specific fix for the Courage Center Allina issue, but we also need to update Minnesota rules, et cetera. And there is a group working on that, but it's not ready now. So by allowing this extension for an additional year, that the program that was started in Courage Center can continue not only as it has for the last year with the merger with Allina, but for an additional year until this. There's an Olmstead Commission. I'm not familiar with it, but it is charged with dealing with future plans for community-based disability services, and it currently is chaired by the Lieutenant Governor, and they're working on rather, as I understand it, significant changes to an employment program or this employment program and working with Deed. So this is an additional temporary fix for another year to allow these folks to continue in their employment following the merger with Allina and Courage Center.
Okay, quorum is present. So are there any questions?
And I have plenty of people here to testify if it's necessary.
No. How many? We got lots of time. So, Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Should ask one question, shouldn't I?
Yes, you should.
Senator, how much has been expended so far? Did you mention that? I might have missed that. I'm sorry if I did. Do you know?
No, and I don't. I don't know the answer. Maybe the person from Deed knows. I know that as that person is coming forward, in 2013, served a total of 60 people, and in the beginning of the year, the average wage was $11.50 an hour. At the end of the year, the average wage was $11.70 an hour. But maybe you could direct your question to the witness.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Welcome to the committee. Just say your name for the record, please.
Good afternoon. My name is Kimberly Peck. I'm Director of Vocational Rehabilitation Services with DEED.
Go ahead, Senator.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The question I had was, how much has it been expended since the bill had the authority to expend appropriations?
Mr. Chair, members, my understanding is that the dollar amount of the contract with Courage Illini is $185,000. And what's unique to the extended employment program is that the services are reimbursed based on an hours worked by individuals that are in the extended employment program. So it is based on the performance of the provider, ensuring that individuals with significant disabilities are working in competitive employment, and then they are reimbursed based on the number of hours worked by those participants. The track record, if you will, that Courage has had is outstanding. They typically have had some of our best outcomes, and so we're eager to be able to continue our partnership with Courage Illini.
Thank you.
Senator Westrom.
Mr. Chair, just to that point, when you say good outcomes, getting persons with disabilities successfully employed, is that, I mean, that's the outcomes you're measuring, right?
Mr. Chair, Senator Westrom, that's correct. Employment in the community in an integrated setting, paying a prevailing wage.
Very good. That's good news to hear. And Senator Rest, if I can follow up, basically you're just looking for an extension until of what's been allowed, just for one more year to work out
until
some
issues. Mr. Chairman, Senator Westrom, until the overhaul of the in this whole area, which is being undertaken now by this Olmstead Commission, I'm hoping that would be presented, ready to be presented in the 2015 session. But to keep this program going, particularly based on the fact that there was this merger, that's why this language was introduced last year, and then again, this is just a simple extension of it.
Very good. Thank you.
Senator Sparks, you want to move this?
I'll move it, Bill. Yeah, I'll move that Senate file. Where's it going, Mr. Chair?
We're going to refer it to Finance, and there's a chance if we have an omnibus bill, it might pop up in the omnibus bill also. Okay. So Senator Sparks moves Senate file 2205 be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Finance. Any further discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, motion adopted. Thank you, Senator Rest. Senator Hayden.
Yes, sir.
I thought I saw you sneak in.
He doesn't sneak much.
Senate Files 2364. Senator Hayden, welcome to the committee.
Good. Thank you so much, Mr. Chair and committee, for hearing us. Senate File 2364 is regarding a small business incubator initiative. Incubators have a track record of ensuring success for startup businesses. This bill would make capital improvements to five existing incubators located in Minneapolis-St. Paul, establish an acquisition/development fund to assist the creation of new incubators, and target increased services at businesses located in existing incubators that are well-positioned to grow their business and job. NDC does not receive any state funds for operations. Existing NDC businesses, over 400 currently return $5+ million in state income and sales tax. NDC also can't use bond funds for improvement because they're privately owned. Targeted businesses will receive the focus on helping existing business incubators that are appear to be poised to expand. Acquisition and Development Fund would help acquire new properties once developed. The fund can be used again for the next opportunity. NDC is the Neighborhood Development Center, Mr. Chair, and my interest in this, beyond what my prepared remarks are, is that many of you know in the heart of my district there was an old Sears building that was kind of the regional Sears building. The city of Minneapolis over the last 20 years has helped with a bunch of groups redevelop it, and it is now the home to Allina Healthcare Systems World Headquarters, very closely attached to Abbott Northwestern and Children's Hospital. They also have apartments and condos that took over the historic site. And then the centerpiece of that, at least in my eyes, maybe some in business will look at it differently, was the global market in which you can go and kind of get a taste of the world through cuisine and arts and crafts, as well as there's a halal meat market there and other things that has really made it a great opportunity for people and a great destination place for people to come. Today I have Mike Tamale and others here to talk a little bit about what has been happening there and why we would be looking for an appropriation for them to help.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you very much. My name is Mike Tamale. I'm the CEO of the Neighbor Development Center. I'm here with Damon Johnson, who's the owner of The Grooming House, a fantastic barbershop at University and Dale inside one of our projects, Frogtown Square. So I'm just going to talk for a moment about what we do and what we're asking for. I appreciate your time. In general, we provide extensive entrepreneur training to low-income folks in five different languages in about 20 different neighborhoods in Minneapolis, St. Paul, Eden Prairie, Brooklyn Center, and Hopkins. This is a 20-week-long class. We've trained over 4,500 people in this 20-week-long class. Following the class, then the folks that move on to actually open their business, they can apply to us for financing. So we do lending as our second step. Our first step is the training. Our second step is lending, and this is mostly startup businesses, some expansion. 82% persons of color in these businesses. We use deed money from urban initiatives. We use deed money from the Emerging Entrepreneur Fund. We use federal dollars. We use philanthropic dollars. We're a nonprofit 501c3. Once folks are in business, then we provide ongoing technical assistance to them, business assistance of all sorts. So it's branding their business, marketing the business, legal help, accounting help, et cetera. We've got almost 500 people in business today. Collectively, they're returning over $75 million a year to the regional economy, including $5 million of state taxes annually. They have a payroll over $25 million, over 2,000 employees collectively. So these are real small little micro mom-and-pop entrepreneurs that, in an aggregate, are really improving our regional economy. In particular, they're improving the neighborhood economy. So what we try to do is concentrate them in certain inner-city neighborhoods or communities of color. And the best way we have to do that, actually, is in our five different business incubators. So Senator Hayden mentioned the Global Market. We also have the Mercado Central. We have Frogtown Square at University and Dale, et cetera. And inside of these five real estate projects, we have 120 of our businesses located. They're highly visible. They're quite successful. And it's a hybrid model for us. So it's one part, you know, business model, for-profit model, in the sense that these buildings are real estate projects that need the cash flow, and one part nonprofit. So the mission we have is to elevate each of these businesses with all the technical assistance we have. So what we're asking for is the help that Senator Hayden mentioned, which is to upgrade a few of our older projects and investigate some new projects. We'd like to see if we can do a business incubator on the east side of St. Paul, the north side of Minneapolis, and potentially in Eden Prairie. We've been training Somali entrepreneurs in Eden Prairie recently, and Senator Hahn came to a graduation we had just a month ago and expressed a lot of interest in this type of entrepreneur development in that community. So what I'd like to ask now is for Damon to talk a little bit about his experience in the incubator and in the business.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Tamale. And go ahead, Mr. Johnson. Please introduce yourself for the record.
My name is Damon Johnson, co-owner of Grooming House Barbershop, located on the corner of University and Dale in the Frogtown Square building, one of the incubators that he was talking about. I really appreciate what they've done for us and other businesses. We're actually able to go from a small four-chair shop to nine. We actually were able to use them to help us formulate our business plan and also help us with our financial issues as well, helping us get our credit together to be able to apply for the loans and also able to get a loan through them to help us with our new location. Pearl Amayo helped us with our business plan and loan. They also helped us with many other things. I have another project that I've been working on, a mobile application, which the NDC was able to help me out with a lawyer to help me to patent, file a patent for the product that we're trying to put together. So we're now waiting for that to be cleared as well. It's very priceless, the things that they've been able to do for me and my business partner. They helped us to get access to a lot of services and things that we wouldn't have been able to afford on our own without their help.
Okay, thank you very much, Mr. Johnson. Any question from committee members? Yes, Senator Weber.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. just one question I have regarding the incubator, and I know we have initiated incubators in my hometown. And now you've mentioned that some of the businesses have been able to expand their sites and that type of thing. Is there an expectation that at some certain point when the business is up and running and has achieved good success that they leave the incubator to make room for other businesses for startup?
That's a common model nationally, but that's not how we do it. Mr. Chair and Senator Weber.
Mr. Tamale, go ahead.
Sorry. It's not an uncommon model, but we don't use that model in part because I'd say the bulk of our 120 tenants in our five incubators are actually retail. And so if they actually picked up and moved, it would be a real problem for their business. But instead what we do is we try to help them expand into a second location, a third location. So Sonora Grill was an article that maybe is attached to your handout. They just opened up a large sit-down restaurant on Lake Street coming out of the global market in a real small stall. That's a typical example of how we try to grow the businesses.
Mr. Johnson?
Mr. Chair, I can speak on that as well because actually that's another part that we're working on now is looking for a location for our expansion because we're actually at full capacity in the shop that we're at now. So we're looking to expand, and also some of our barbers are actually going through the same program to be a part of that expansion.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yes, Senator Ingram-Gleason.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Senator Hayden, for bringing this forward. The Sears Tower is kind of interesting. My auntie, who just recently passed, probably, I think, put 40 years in there working for Sears. So as a young child, I rode that bus occasionally down to that, to me, very large building at that time. It still is, and I'm glad that they're able to use it for something. I know the there was talk of doing that for a long time, and it seems like it's been utilized properly. But question I have, well, one other question, by the way. If I go there, would you come with me and tour the Sears Tower, Senator Hayden?
Absolutely, Senator Ingram-Gleason, I'd be glad to
show you around. All right, thank you. Thank you. The other question I have is somewhat similar to what Senator Weber has, and I don't understand that if we're getting the business off the ground and we're becoming a successful business, are we going to be taking that business then and expanding? I understand the concept. But I'm wondering if we're not missing out on some other entrepreneurs that are needing that same thing to get that jump start. Am I missing something here, or is it continuously working with these same businesses, this expenditure, and is it always in the metro area? Is there anything available for rural Minnesota?
Senator Hayden or Mr. Mike?
Well, I'll let Mr. Tamale finish it. I think the model that Mr. Tamale talked about is that these businesses, so for instance, in the Midtown Global Market, they've developed their businesses there. People come there because they want to go have Jerusalem Deli or, you know, Safari, Somali food or whatever, and that's the draw. So what they want to do is keep those businesses there so people can still continue to go there. But as the instead of looking at it as the expansion that they move, that they would open up a second place, right? And that they would start those business models in those facilities. Mm-hmm. New entrepreneurs can also join them, and then we start to create these, you know, I don't know. For me, it's when I always go to Mexico, I think about how El Centro, right, the downtown works, and so people come to an open market. And so a lot of the concepts, maybe not all, but a lot of them, at least the one at the Midtown Global Market, creates that kind of, you know, marketplace, central marketplace. So I think that Neighborhood Development Center is always working with new entrepreneurs to find out where best they are. So I think that there is enough people who want to do it. What we're hoping to do is to continue to support them to find places in communities to help build a central market or a main street opportunity in those particular neighborhoods and parts of town. I will also say what attracts me, and I've been working with Mr. Tamale for a long time, is, you know, we all talk about small business and what it does for communities and who they hire, and they hire people that are familiar to them. Those same opportunities are happening in some of these depressed communities or communities that are challenged, and some of them that I represent. So it's a great opportunity to get people moving. And though we have the safety net system, I think we all would say that the safety net system is supposed to be that, a net, but not some place where people stop. And so these opportunities, what the barbershop and others are doing, is they're moving people up and moving people out of poverty by not only giving them the financial wherewithals, the understanding of business, but also giving them hope. And I think that that's really important as we move forward. But I'll let you also talk about your model in Greater Minnesota or other places.
Mr. Tamale, go ahead. Mr. Tamale.
So, first, Mr. Yeah. Chair and Senator Ingebretson, first of all, we're open-minded to the idea both yourself and Senator Weber have brought up about, you know, is there models of this that would rotate people a little bit quicker? There is turnover, obviously, in these places, and even if it's the same folks in these, to some extent, we don't work with them the same way year after year. We try to taper it down. They need to fly on their own. There's a tough love model built into this, so they get more help on day one and way less help a year later. And this incubator program of ours is one part of the broader entrepreneur training and lending and technical assistance program that we offer. So even if they're not in one of our buildings, folks can get this kind of a help. It's just that these incubators have a uniquely powerful impact on both the entrepreneurs and the community. So, I mean, we're intrigued by actually the I'm intrigued by the notion of, you know, are there at least some types of business that maybe they're not the retailers? Maybe there we have some incubators that have more office tenants. It could be contractors or translators or whatever. Can we rotate those through a little bit? That's certainly worth talking about. With regards to rural, you know, we're available to provide our model to anybody. I mean, we don't pretend to be an expert in places that we're not an expert in. But we've been working for a couple years with a group in Fargo, Senator Ingebretson, on a model like the Global Market. We've been working with a group in Portland, Oregon, on a model like the Mercado Central. So we're available to assist any community that has that interest.
Looks like Mr. Johnson wanted to make a comment.
Oh,
Mr.
yeah, Johnson. And I was just going to say one of the biggest things about those incubators and those spaces is it's really helped with the community to bring them out of those poverty situations. So even with those businesses being able to stay there, it does, like you said, give the other ones around hope to see that there is opportunities and things to do. Even since I've been involved with NDC, when I first got involved with the program, I was a lot younger than I am now. My grandmother, which is a barber, actually is the one that brought me to the program. And just in that period of time, from the time I was probably about 20 years old to now being 33, I've seen the growth and even the many other opportunities that have opened for the other businesses. So there are some that may have stayed there, but there are also other locations and different things that they've expanded to that offer more opportunities. And then in turn, people like me, when I started out my business, I was able to go and have close contact with those other businesses that could also give me support and advice on things that I should do as well.
Thank you, Mrs. Johnson. Senator Scalzi?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to Senator Ingebrigtsen's question, I'm just kind of wondering. I don't see any wording in here that would limit it to Metro, but I do have to agree with Senator Ingebrigtsen that there, you know, we've got great numbers of immigrant communities in outstate Minnesota that are working low-wage jobs, and I would think that this type of thing would really help some of these communities. So I have to say, if we think that a business incubator is a good thing, and it certainly sounds like it with the training and the lending, I just don't know why we would want to restrict it to places like the global market when, in fact, there might be a mini global market in Worthington or elsewhere that could use some help.
Well, thank you, Senator Scalzi. Mr. Chair, yeah, I don't think that. I think what we're reflecting was Neighborhood Development Center work today that we're in population centers. That traditionally where immigrants have started to congregate. I think we all know that we're starting to get more throughout the state. As a matter of fact, I look at Senator Sparks today. Unfortunately, my son's high school beat his hometown high school this Friday. I'm counting the votes, Senator. So. But there was a lot of representation of ethnic communities in the city of Austin is where I'm going. So I don't think that we would want to limit it to these spots in the metro area. I just think that those were the places in which there was a good amount of people in which Mr. Tamale's organization started.
Senator Osmak.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to Senator Hayden, just to confirm, this is the money coming out for this particular bill is coming off the bottom line of the surplus, correct? Coming from general fund?
Senator Hayden.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Osmak, you know, what I would propose is that, you know, we always lay these over and that we would, you know, take a look at that as the chair's pleasure and as the finance chair. So I would suggest that that's where it would come from, but I, you know, I'm not a part of this committee, so.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Senator, I was just confirming that since it's general fund, I just wasn't sure was where it was coming from, but right. There's nothing wrong with that. I just wanted to confirm it. And then, Mr. Chair, one additional question.
Yes.
I just lost my train of thought. I'll come back to it. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any other comment from senators and committee members? Okay.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair.
All right, Senator Osmak.
Just realized what it was. Mr. Chair and Senator Hayden, how are you measuring success in this for this appropriation? We're putting out almost $1 million. You know, is there some measurable results that we would see? Is there something that that economic development that we will be able to quantify or be able to say what kind of return on investment we're going to be getting for this?
Good. Mr. Chair, Senator Osmak, I'll let Mr. Tamale talk a little bit about how they measure the outcomes of the folks that they help.
Mr. Tamale.
So, Mr. Chair and Senator Osmak, we have every 2 years we hire Wilder Research from the Wilder Foundation to do a third-party year-long program impact evaluation of our work. And they, one of the particular areas they focus on are our incubators to see if they're more successful than our general program in terms of outcomes. So the outcomes we're looking for are businesses started, employment, business growth, salaries of employees, et cetera. And we're tracking that, and we're able to track that going backwards and forwards in these incubators. Beyond that, we have basic real estate measures, which is are these projects self-sustaining, which is our goal. Most of them are, not all of them right now, and we're working very hard to get all of them at break even or better. And then there's another measure that we'd like to track that we haven't, which is spin-off development around there, whether it's real estate development or business development. But we track all the you know, the payments made by these entrepreneurs on payroll, on taxes, on supplies and rent and so on. So they're aggregate putting back money into the regional and local economy. That's aggregated, and we can do that by incubator as well. And then we can contrast that against our general program to see how we're doing.
Mr. Chair, one follow-up.
Senator Hausman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And that's good information. I guess I would have a question on how you filter out organic growth from the actual growth because of the amount of money we put in. There's a lot of growth, economic development, and economic growth that organically will happen regardless of how much money you put in or how much money you don't put in. Do you have any insight into the methodology that shows that you can compare or contrast or figure out if the money actually made a difference versus, yes, there was economic growth, and I'm sure us throwing $1 million at something will create some type of an effect, but do we have any way to quantify the actual results of this as opposed to we're going to have some growth?
Mr. Tamale.
So, Mr. Chair and Senator Osmond, that's a great challenge to us, to be honest. We can contrast the outcomes we get from our training and our lending and our technical assistance within our incubators against national statistics, which I'm sure you've heard over the years. But, 80% of all small businesses fail in the first 5 years was a measure from 20 years ago from MIT. That number moves around a little bit. But we can contrast our business launch and business survival rates against national data from the SBA and from other institutions. And at this point, we're dramatically above those kinds of national outcomes. But I'd love to work on that challenge a little bit because we have 15 years of data and research from Wilder. But I'm not sure we've put that exactly to them in that fashion, and that'd be very interesting to do.
Thank you, Ms. Tamale. Any other comment or question? Okay, with that, then we will lay over for Senate Bill 2364 for possible inclusion on the omnibus bill. Thank you,
Senator. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Yes.
Thank you very much.
And next on the schedule is 17 Senate File 1748, Senator Saxhall. Welcome, Senator Saxhall.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. As you stated today, I have Senate File 1748. This bill makes changes to a prior appropriation for shooting sports facilities. This change will provide a $100,000 grant to the Itasca County Gun Club for shooting sports facility improvements. I'd say a little bit about the Itasca County Gun Club. It has about 900 members. It's open to the public and is for the Itasca County areas where the public learns how to shoot and much of the gun safety conducted in this area is done here also. The reason they need the grant is because the Itasca Gun Club is located on a piece of land very close to what used to be abandoned iron ore facilities. However, Magnetation, which is a company that recycles tailings ponds and ore dumps to wind up with about a 60% concentrate, which is then shipped out, own the mineral rights under the Gun Club. And although they've pledged and have already a lot of in-kind work, they have heavy equipment and actual dollars, it will take more than just their contributions to move the Gun Club to the proper position that it needs to be in. So with that, with me today is Bob Meyer here?
I think he stepped out.
Bob Meyer stepped out. he was going to explain the bill. I think I explained the bill.
Yes, you did.
And pretty much the background. So
yeah, maybe
I'll be open for questions.
Sure. Senator Saxhall, would you like to make this bill on its own, or you want to be included in an omnibus bill?
I just need to make sure that it's moving, Senator.
Mr. Chair, I'll move the bill.
Yes, if it's moved, then it will go to the Finance Committee. And
okay.
So which part do you prefer?
Well, I'd just soon have it both ways, Mr. Chair.
blatantly honest, anyhow.
So, yeah.
Okay, let's jokes
let's
that can happen.
Contemplate on that.
But
okay, let's contemplate on that for a little while Mr. Bob Meyer from DNR speak on this about this bill. Yeah, go ahead, Mr. Meyer.
Mr. Chairman, members of the record, Bob Meyer, Department of Natural Resources. This is an issue we have been working with Senator Saxog on and also other members who made this appropriation several years ago. These dollars have been appropriated for a project within the metropolitan area that we have done a request for information on, a pre-design. I know there's another bill in this committee for $2 million to do grants at a much larger scale for shooting ranges. We're interested in working on that proposal as well, but through the biennial budget process next year, due to the increases that we've been receiving in Pittman-Robertson dollars, the federal excise tax on guns and ammunition. In the meantime, this language here, which is also, I should mention, in the Game and Fish bill that will be coming to you shortly as well, is a compromise that the department has worked out with Senator Saxog and others that would allow some of these dollars that were previously appropriated to be used for Itasca County Gun Club, as we have been working with them to find a new home. And then we would also be able to free up the other part of the appropriation to be used to provide for firearm safety training areas within public lands, primarily wildlife management areas, where we would be installing small backstops and infrastructure shooting benches for students to participate in the requirements of the shooting portion of a firearm safety program. Basically, it's required that they take 25 rounds of live ammunition fire with a 22 caliber rifle. So these dollars would allow us to do those types of activities in various wildlife management areas throughout the state.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Meyer. Any question or comments for Senator Saxon or Mr. Meyer? Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Deputy Commissioner Meyer, the pre-design and shooting sports facility in the Seven County Metro area, was that not funded at one time?
Commissioner?
Some years ago?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Ingebrigtsen, that was out of those $300,000 that we're talking about. And we did do the work. We did. It was about, I think we've allocated approximately $25,000 to do the design work. The story of this appropriation goes back, oh, geez, I believe it was 2009 probably. 2008, where the House had ideas of creating a large publicly run shooting facility down at Vermilion Highlands Research and Wildlife Management Area down in Rosemount. We had just recently acquired it we're operating it. We don't actually take possession of it for probably 14 more years from the University of Minnesota. But at that point in time, some members wanted to create a large, by large I mean 20, 30, 40 trap ranges facility in that area. If you look at Illinois, they have a facility called Sparta. Sparta, Illinois, I think if you would Google it, you would see the shooting range that they have there, and they have national shoots. It's on an old reclaimed mining area, so it does present some opportunity to do that. But the vision was actually Representative Dill was ahead of the curve on the high school trap league situation that we're facing right now. If you've been following the news, the high school, I believe it's an endorsed sport actually through the high school league, but the growth in the high school trap league is phenomenal. And there's a facility actually in your district, Representative Senator Ingebrigtsen, I believe, in Alexandria, right along 94 there, that they hold the state high school trap meet. And what the intention was of this original appropriation was to design a facility that then they could come back and appropriate bonding dollars to build that would accommodate the need for these statewide shoots. Working through that issue and several legislative sessions kind of brought us to this point now where the need is still there, but there's some angst amongst the local shooting clubs, the privately run shooting facilities, that the state get into this business. And we're still working for that, and I know there's still members who have a desire to have a statewide facility somewhere, but there's a lot of information that needs to be dealt with before we would get to that point. So I think this language allows us a compromise to appropriate these dollars for a couple uses that are short-term needs, and looking at that larger proposal that the Minnesota Conservation Federation is moving forward for the $2 million in grants through the biennial process next year, and using those Pittman Robertson dollars is the direction we would like to move forward with.
Senator Ingram-Brisson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just to follow up with that, so that is the program that was I think there was a significant amount of money that was spent on that area. Those of you in wherever from Minnesota should know that the private gun clubs raise their money various ways, and I think Senator Saxog talked about that in the bill. And yes, in fact, we do have a very significant size one sporting clay facility in Alexandria, and that is where I learned of this to start with. And the reason they brought it to my attention was 3-4 years ago, I believe, as you mentioned, Mr. Meyer, was that they put their gun club together by themselves. This was going to be, as you said, funded by the state of Minnesota. And there was huge angst over that. Was the state of Minnesota going to start taking away business from these clubs that work so very hard for their dollars to keep the doors open? And yes, it is a growing sport. I mean, there's no question about it. It's kind of interesting, kind of fun to see the shooting clays move into the high school curriculum and participate. I think it's a statewide thing that can really take off here. It has already taken off. I don't know how many thousands of shooters we have that are in the high school league, but it's fairly significant. But I do have problems with the state of Minnesota coming in when we do seem to have, at least at this point, somewhat adequate facilities throughout the state of Minnesota, I guess. And I guess if they're going to be funding the metro ones with state money, then I think the outstate ones are going to be coming in and asking for money as well, and quite frankly, they should. So I really have a problem with that.
Mr. Chairman, just a point of clarification that this language in this bill doesn't deal with any of that, right? We fully understand the concerns of the privately operated gun ranges, and we need to address those as we move forward. This language would allow $200,000 of this appropriation for the DNR to use on state lands to provide for firearm safety shooting courses for the demand out there from our students. The other money would be funded as a grant to the Itasca County Gun Club to help them deal with their relocation costs due to the magnification facility. And actually, it's tied up. It's actually a school trust fund lands issue as well. So what we're trying to do is come to a happy medium that would allow the state to be able to continue to meet our growing demands, also work with Itasca County. But, Senator, to your point, for us to be successful, we have to create a public-private partnership. And I think we'll come back with a biennial budget process or proposal next year that would actually do that and allow these grants to be used for some of those facilities.
Just one more follow-up, if I could, Mr.
Yes,
Chair.
Yes, go ahead, Senator.
The bill is very specific to a 7-county metro area. Am I reading something wrong there?
That's council.
Mr. Chair, Senator Ingerson, that's the existing law, that we're amending. The question is whether you leave that in existing law or not. I mean, you know, another option for you that would be to delete that part of it. But that would be actually striking existing language if you did that. What this does is it broadens the use. So it leaves the existing law alone, says that if they can spend it on the 7-county metro area shooting sports facility, they can do that. But it also expands the use of that $200,000 to other options. And I think Mr. Meyer talked about they're not sure they would spend any more on that metropolitan facility. It sounds like their intent is to use the $200,000 to provide additional opportunities for their firearm safety instructors and students. So I don't think whether it says whether you leave the existing law about the 7-county metropolitan area in there or not, I'm not sure it's going to matter very much because they've already spent what they're going to spend on it.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Senator Ingram-Brisson, and I do apologize. I should have been more clear in my comments. The work, the study, pre-design and design has been completed. We feel that that work has been done. I think it was that work that led to the angst of some of your constituents and concerns. That has been laid on the table, and nothing will move forward until basically a large bonding bill or some type of appropriation from the legislature would be made to fund any type of facility, which we aren't even looking at this point in time. So we're looking at freeing up the other $200,000, as Mr. Knopf said, for basic firearm hunter education.
Senator Ingram-Brisson. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just one more follow-up. I don't remember, Mr. Meyer, what you said, the dollars expended, but I do recall a figure of $500,000. So that work is already done. Those monies are already expended on that metro plan. In fact, I think I had that plan on my desk at one time, a very extensive gun club plan. So you're telling me that's already done and this can be used to expand for hunter education. And so,
Mr. Chairman, Senator Ingram-Brisson, yes, and the work, I want to say, of that proposal was in about the $25,000 to $50,000 range. All it was a set of drawings, kind of concept designs that we had an architectural firm draw, pull together, which you are referring to. So. Yep.
Thanks.
Okay, Senator Scalzi.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And in line of that type of thought, I have no problem with this $100,000 to go to the Itasca County Gun Club, which is, an unusual case. I do have a family member that is in a trap league, she goes to a private gun club. She goes to the one north in White Bear, the Bald Eagle Rod and Gun Club. And I just am a little nervous about this first part of this new language to establish firearm safety and archery ranges on public land. I also agree that I think that may run afoul of what some of the other groups are trying to do without state funding. And if somebody gets state funding, that everyone's going to want state funding, I would think. But the question I have for you is, if you say that's going to go to wildlife management areas, a shooting range is very different from just a wildlife management area. You would be establishing a shooting range. Or how would you let people know who may be in there that there is a shooting range? That's what I don't understand.
Mr. Chair, Senator Scalzi, and thank you for the opportunity here. I think it's key. It says on public land, this could be in a state forest as well, places like that. We already have some public shooting facilities in state forest property. There's one up by the in the Brainerd area that we've been dealing with a little bit. These would only be open for very specific purposes and only with a certified firearm and safety instructor or a bow hunter education instructor. It's not like we're creating new ranges that would be open for public shooting, so to speak. These would be for very specific uses. What we're seeing is our firearm safety instructors have a shortage. Hesitate to bring this up, we had a long debate about using publicly funded shooting ranges several sessions ago, and this is to help alleviate some of that pressure, right, that we can do these activities for firearm safety on public land. Most of these will be in outstate Minnesota, where in Bemidji or Brainerd or places like that, where students are traveling long ranges to long miles to do this shooting, the firearms field safety training day. So we're looking at providing some new opportunities to take that pressure off of these gun clubs, as Bald Eagle or the Metros or Oakdale gun clubs now are giving up their for-profit shooting times to provide opportunities for these students to come in. So we're seeing pressures on their demands for our kids, our students, to meet the needs, and we're trying to provide that opportunity for them with these dollars. So we look at it as a positive thing, not a competition thing at all.
Thank you, Mr. Meyer. Senator Osmak, do you still want to move this bill?
Oh, sure.
Okay. Just make me a little nervous.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I'd request, if Senator Osmak's going to move this, that I would request that the bill be laid over for possible inclusion in the committee omnibus bill.
Okay. That's sounds good. Then we shall lay over Senate File 1748 for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Thank you. And Senator Tomasoni, do you?
You're doing good.
Yeah. Okay. All right. And then again, Senator Saxall, Senate File 2102.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. Senate File 2102. This bill appropriates money to the University of Minnesota to develop new techniques to control terrestrial invasive species, which are a growing problem for Minnesota's forest industry, but not just the forest industry, for the people of Minnesota and their lands. We've been putting quite a bit of emphasis on aquatic invasive species over the last number of years, and you know, all of a sudden it kind of came to mind, let's see now, we've got emerald ash borer over the whole state, moving into the really large ash forests that we have in northern Minnesota. We have the gypsy moss, which we're talking about quarantines in northeastern Minnesota. We've got all sorts of these terrestrial invasive species that are developing in Minnesota, and some to come, obviously, and you know, some will leave, some will come. So the key here is that I've got I don't have Dave Zemeta with me up here. So I'm going to ask these two experts on what's going to happen over at the University of Minnesota, the dean of the College of Natural Resources, the University of Minnesota, and a department head, and they're going to introduce themselves and talk a little bit about the bill before Mr. Zemeta, the executive director of the Minnesota Forest Resources Council, makes his appearance at the table.
Okay. I assume it's Professor Brian Burr?
Yes.
Okay. Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Brian Burr. I'm professor and dean of College of Food, Agricultural, and Natural Resource Science at the University of Minnesota. Well, thank you for entertaining us as we visit about the possibilities of the University of Minnesota addressing terrestrial invasive species in Minnesota. From an impact standpoint, as Senator Saxall just mentioned, we estimate that terrestrial invasive species have $134 billion a year impact on the U.S. and probably approximately a $3 to $4 billion impact in Minnesota from loss of use of commercial lands as well as private lands, ecosystem service losses, and so on. Also, you said there's many dimensions to the problem, from insects such as the emerald ash borer. We have a new arrival recently, a spotted winged Drosophila, that's affecting our small fruit crops, grapes, strawberries, raspberries, blueberries. They're not very pleasant when they arrive. They get into the blueberry, and you'll see the blueberry move as you're going to eat it, so you can imagine the impact that has on consumer demand and willingness to go out and pick their own blueberries and strawberries and so on, affecting that industry as well as our burgeoning wine-growing industry, which, of course, is growing in the state as we're developing winter-hardy grapes and so on. It also affects agricultural crops, things like soybean rust or weeds that affect those crops. So it's very broadly impacting the state of Minnesota in many dimensions, both our public lands and private as well. The research we envision doing largely focuses on the designated invasive pests, plants, or pathogens that are in the state or potential to arrive in the state and spread from that aspect. One of the core avenues we'll take for this, because there's such a broad-based dimension of this problem, both across the state and with the different species, is to do some net impact assessment, which basically means looking at what is the potential for this invasive to spread, what's the potential for it to arrive in the state, how effective can we be at controlling and either eliminating or eradicating that pest, and then what are the costs of doing those activities. So really, at the outset, looking at where can we have our greatest impact, whether it's in our forests, our wetlands, our prairies, wherever that problem exists. We'll also be looking at new control methods, including biocontrol, certainly across the spectrum of other technologies, integrated pest management. We've visited a bit about, although it's not part of this bill, the idea of having citizen partnerships in helping to identify and then also eradicate. One of the things we find is one of the most effective and also important things to do is have people out surveilling what's happening on various lands that aren't often used or frequented by others. And by doing that, we'd be able to more effectively and in a timely way identify spread. And then oftentimes we ask citizens to go out and, for example, pull weeds in prairies, for example, as an effective removal process. But thinking about incorporating broader participation in some of these projects. We're looking, as we develop control methods, to consider minimizing non-target impacts. And so, for example, one of the issues, of course, you'll hear we're working on quite a bit now is bee colony collapse. And oftentimes, some of that is affected by whether it's herbicides, pesticides we're using on the landscape. So trying to find impacts that have relatively limited effects across other areas than the targeted invasives. And we would, of course, look to collaborate, as we already, with the DNR, the Minnesota Department of Ag, other state agencies, and, as I said, citizen groups to move this forward. So a fairly broad-based approach, but still trying to target and be most effective with how we address these invasive species. Our ability to do this and our capacity is important. As a college, we have very diverse, we talk about insects, plants, and so on. I've already visited with the department heads across our college, including entomology, horticulture, agronomy, forest resources, plant pathology, fisheries, wildlife, conservation biology, agronomy, and bioengineering. All of those departments would have a role and already do have some role in addressing some of the issues of invasive species, whether it's monitoring, whether it's control methods, whether it's simply trying to identify and find where invasive species are and track those. They've all agreed this is an important part of their research programs, and they're ready to participate with us as we move this forward. In addition, it's always worth bringing up that we have 8 regional outreach centers associated with the college as part of the Minnesota Agricultural Experiment Station. And as we look at invasive species, it does go from forest lands to the agricultural lands in the south, to prairies, to wetlands. It goes across the broad landscape dimensions of the state. And so we're looking to partner and use those research outreach centers, which on one of these slides I do have the locations, but they are spread throughout the state of Minnesota. It gives us not only the capacity to reach those different landscapes and invasives, but it also allows us to use those as field sites for doing the research we're trying to undertake. So an important part of this project that we have in place for that capacity as well. A little bit about staffing and structure, and of course that depends on levels of funding, which haven't been determined for this or requested yet. But we do view that we will need a faculty research leader, someone as we're working across these disciplines who can help to coordinate the research activities going on within that scope. And we would view that person, primarily as a researcher, engaged in the research projects, but being able to talk across these scientific issues. We would position the center similar to the Water Resources Center, which is also at the University of Minnesota that many of you may be familiar with. Because this will likely go across college boundaries as well, we'd like the center to report directly to the dean of the college and be at that level so that you could work across the various disciplines and roles that others might play in addressing this problem. To give you some idea, we'd be looking, and this is just in terms of giving some sense of the cost of this. Because we have the researchers largely in place, the expertise in entomology or plant pathology is there. The key input we're looking for is the funding of graduate students to help support the projects and do the research, the lab work, and be out in the field working on that. Those students cost about $40,000 a year. In addition, we'd look for research support for these projects. And roughly, and we haven't vetted out what any particular invasive would cost to do, but if we consider each graduate assistant would preferably work with that faculty member, required about $50,000 in research dollars. It would go directly to addressing whatever that research topic is related to control or removal or elimination of those species. And over 5 to 10 years, that'd be about $4.5 to $9 million we'd be looking at. Four and a half over 5 years, nine over 10 years, roughly speaking, to be able to address what we think would be a reasonable scope to begin to have an impact on some of the more pernicious invasive species. So with that, I'll simply say that CFANS, we view this as a very important problem across many of these industries, across the public sector of our wetlands, prairies, and so on. We do have the multidisciplinary capacity to address this. We have the research and facilities capacities, and especially in the research and outreach centers. And so we're very much looking forward to collaborating with the state, with our state agencies, the DNR, Minnesota Department of Agriculture, to help to address this serious problem for Minnesota. Thank you very much, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Professor Burr. And Dr. Galatowicz, right? Am I close?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. I'm Susan Gladowicz. I'm a professor and department head of fisheries, wildlife, and conservation biology, and was one of the PI's principal investigators on a recent invasive species training program and involved in AIS as well.
Any question, comment from the senators? Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Sachsel, you're right. There's been a lot of money spent on invasive species research over the last years, and both for the zebra mussel, of course, the most recent carp issue coming up the river. I'm wondering, and I've been around here for a little while now, and actually a short stint on LCCMR, but there, I'm wondering, I see the executive director here today, I'm wondering if there has been any expenditures in this area, or maybe you know of any expenditures from LCCMR for research. I know they have been research, somewhat research-based. Maybe that's not the right thing to say, but a lot of money is being spent, has been spent in the past over the past years from LCCMR on research on a lot of different areas. I know the Emerald Ash Borer, as well as I think the Lassard Sams also put some dollars in towards that. How much has been spent, I guess, for this terrestrial invasive species? I'm wondering if she would give us a comment. Maybe it'd be a real short comment as $0, but if that were the case, it wouldn't take long.
Okay. Well,
thank you.
Well, welcome, and please introduce yourself for the record.
Mr. Chair and members, I'm Susan Thornton, the director of the Legislative Citizen Commission on Minnesota Resources, LCCMR. And as Senator Ingebrigtsen stated, yes, the LCMR and LCCMR has probably been involved in terrestrial and aquatic invasive species for the last 20 years in funding research. We were asked to work with authors and the University of Minnesota on this initiative. We've been funding individual research projects, and this committee will see several going through in the upcoming bill this session. I would guess probably excluding the aquatic, well, for a terrestrial invasive species, I'd have to look it up. I didn't bring that. Probably $20 million. Plus, but I can get back to the committee on those exact dollars. I think what we're looking at is what is being looked at here is a comprehensive approach, and really to use the university to come back to the legislature, come back to the LCCMR with sort of research priorities. I've had some members say we feel like we're picking critters du jour, if you will, feeling it's good research, but looking at this comprehensive approach, and then they would still be coming back to the LCCMR through the Center for Individual Research requests. And Mr. Chair and members, I'm not here as an advocate of this. We've been sort of working on the facts and the structure together.
Okay. Well, thank you. Senator Scazzi?
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. And my question is the cost, first of all, because it sounds to me like it's a building plus a group of employees. And I'm just kind of wondering, first of all, I just wanted to add that the Capital Investment Committee just toured the U of M St. Paul campus on Thursday related to their number three request for bonding dollars. And that included the carp and the zebra mussels, AIS research facility, and the bee research related to colony collapse, that facility. And then there were also some greenhouses that were doing plant research. And I'm wondering why this wouldn't be sort of rolled in with that type of request. And that, I understand, was mostly for capital building improvements, but that there was also a request in there for a few more people to do the work after they got their capital building improved somewhat. So I'm wondering the cost and why this would not be rolled in with the capital investment request.
Professor Burr.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Senator Scalzi, we at this point we don't have a building request associated with this terrestrial invasive species. The bonding request for the bee lab and the Aquatic Invasive Species Center and the greenhouses is separate from this. This bill is primarily intended to bring together the researchers engaged with this, funding graduate students to build the workforce. And as Susan Thornton just said, trying to build a broader overarching portfolio of how we look at invasive species. Many of the technologies and activities we undertake have implications across species. And what we see happening too often is work going down into a particular species and not getting over to that. So a way to center the activities. So the center is largely a virtual center, I would call it at this point, because we have these multiple departments located across the campus and trying to draw them together into a combined portfolio. And that's why I talk about this net impacts aspect of this, is to try and leverage that most effectively across those departments to gauge where do we identify our greatest impact on solving invasive species problems versus having the, one-time critter du jour, I suppose, is the good thing to use, of having that one-time, here's what's interesting today, but does it get at the broader problem of whether it's broader biocontrol methods, broader policies related to how we address transport of species across state lines or boundaries that then spread them around. So there is not a bonding request associated with this at this point, and that other request is the bonding request for those particular programs.
Thank you, Professor Burr. Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm supportive of this proposal. I just want to have a conversation about setting expectations. I see in the kind of these opening paragraphs, you want to talk about three things, and the second one is our vision for addressing the needs to eliminate, control, or prevent terrestrial invasive species. My question is about elimination. Is that ever possible? Has that ever succeeded? Have we ever eliminated an invasive?
Professor Burr.
Mr. Chair, Senator Dibble, I'm not aware of invasive species. I tend to work in animal health issues, and we have eliminated animal viruses, for example. This last year, rinderpest, which is a significant virus in cattle and cause of death loss, was eradicated. And eradicated is, in terms of this, eliminated from the face of the earth. We've eliminated, for example, smallpox, where we still have viable samples of smallpox, but it's not in the population to the extent we need to vaccinate. So it is a difficult process, and typically when those are eradicated, it does require these multi-pronged activities of not only, for example, vaccination or, chemical, biological controls, managing how we, control movements of livestock, for example, in case of diseases. So I don't know of a case, and perhaps Professor Gladowich may, working in the invasive species sides, have a parallel to what we do see in some diseases. Good comment.
Thanks,
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Mr. Chair and Senator. I think probably our chances of eliminating invasive species are not good. Where it's occurred, it's been mostly on oceanic islands. And so things like, rats and feral pigs and so forth off of islands. So I think realistically controlling the spread, we could eliminate things in a very local sense, but not not at a state scale, I would say.
Thanks. Yeah.
Okay. Do you want to follow up?
Yeah, I just want a comment that
Senator
is. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think we hold in our heads if we just find the right silver bullet, or just do enough buckthorn eradication or whatever, we're going to get rid of it. And I think we just need to grapple with the reality that all we can do maybe is to draw a particular invasive species to a draw, to some sort of equilibrium. I just think we need to get in our heads once they get in. So that's why I think the prevention strategy is probably the most prudent. Keep it out if we can, and keep it from moving if we can. But once it's established, I helped one of my colleagues actually in the House with a buckthorn eradication project a few weeks ago, and we worked very, very hard all day long and had this huge pile of buckthorn afterwards, two of them actually. And kind of stood back and assessed our effect of this kind of wooded hill, and I could barely tell that we'd even touched it. So it's one of those things where I think we're just going to have to set expectations that elimination is probably not something we're going to accomplish with any of these terrestrial invasives or aquatic invasives, for that matter. We just have to figure out how to manage them once they get here to equilibrium.
Thank you, Senator Dibble. Senator Sexall?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I was going to note that some of the more obvious terrestrial invasive species, whether it be emerald ash borer or the gypsy moth, have come from the east and have moved into Minnesota. And it seems, although this is anecdotal, maybe the experts can either back me or not back me up on this, that our friends to the east haven't done a particularly good job of stopping the invasive species. And I think Minnesota has done a much better job than our neighbors to the east, but I think we can do a better job, and I think that's what we're contemplating right here.
Okay. Senator Weber.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I guess I one of the questions I have are comments. Dr. Burr, you mentioned, you referenced in your presentation about work with the Department of Ag, Department of Health, et cetera. I know last year Senator Sparks, as chair of Jobs Ag Rural Development, had us on a tour of the Department of Ag's laboratory facilities and that type of thing. And my question is, what kind of interaction and cooperation exists between the university and the Minnesota Department of Ag, for example, and do you coordinate some of your research activities, or are you both out there sort of doing your own thing, or how does that happen?
With regard to invasive species?
Yes.
I haven't been involved with the invasive species piece, Professor Gladowitz.
Mr. Sure. Chairman and yes. Senator Weber, we work closely with the Department of Agriculture and the Department of Natural Resources, especially on several of the species like emerald ash borer is an example. It's what the state agencies do especially well is the education piece, outreach, and basically engaging the public. What our role typically is research. And so in these sort of instances where something's clearly a threat, we work very closely. What this bill will allow us to do is have increased capacity to handle more of those species that have not arrived yet and do more partnering with them. What we don't want to do is duplicate, and so we don't want to be in the business that they do so well, which is the educational programming and some of those. So sort of modifying how people are how the citizens can do their part in minimizing spread. So we definitely are. The other thing that the agencies are doing to some extent is the risk assessments that we were talking about, that Brian talked about earlier. Those are, we need more capacity to do a more comprehensive sense because of all the critters moving in from the east, and then increasingly from the west, as well as our winters are not usually quite as harsh as they've been, and so that encourages more things to be able to get over the Rocky Mountain Divide, especially forest pests. So we need increased capacity to do those assessments, and oftentimes during those assessments, we identify uncertainties, or the agencies will identify key uncertainties, and those are the kinds of things that the university needs to jump in on and do research to be able to sort of figure out what those threats are in a much more sort of clear way. And so if we can partner more at that assessment end and then partner on more species, I think we'll be able to, really head off, quite a few more of these invasive species threats. But we would want that partnership to continue and to do our part, more aggressively, which is the research part.
Thank you, Ms. Gadlovich. Senator Inkerbrissen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I have to agree wholeheartedly with Senator Dibble's comments about us eliminating. It just isn't going to happen. I think we did a pretty good job with the lamprey on the Great Lakes, but we're just simply holding that at bay. It was going to be devastating, I think, on our lake trout at one time, but now through the research and extensive study, we're able to at least keep them at bay, if you will. Zebra mussels in my area, everybody thought, and I guess they're all over the state of Minnesota now, but my area was quite infested, and there were people coming to the table at one time thinking we were going to eliminate them by spending lots of money, and that's just not been the case. And we're seeing that more and more, and Senator Saxhog and I got involved in that in the Lassard Sams this year, and those are tough decisions to make, to say we're not going to do some things, and then we go back and read the newspaper, here's another lake infested again. So it's just almost impossible. So we have to redirect our dollars. Question I would have is the eight research centers that you have throughout the state of Minnesota must have been at least now giving input to the University of Minnesota with regards to invasive species in their areas, whether it be forestry, whether it be out in the prairie. I know University of Minnesota Morris has one of those outreach centers. So are you saying that that's not happening now, or this is going to beef that up? Or, again, we get back into you talked about duplicate measures and not wanting to duplicate. Are we going to be – is this bill meant to pull all that together, if you will, or are we kind of operating out there by ourselves? Are you not getting information now with regards to the invasives?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Ingebrigtsen, We are working on specific projects now. For example, there is a project at Grand Rapids working on the spotted wing Drosophila in fruits to look at what the impacts of those are. We're working with forestry and Cloquet on the emerald ash borer, as you say. The idea behind this is primarily to draw those efforts together rather than having individual researchers doing individual projects, individual pieces to look at can we strategically, you know, address a broad array of these issues by collaborating across these fields. And it's not that they're not collaborating now, but the research outreach centers often have research staff there as well as some faculty. And if those faculty aren't engaged in the research project, faculty on campus might be engaged. So looking to really build the comprehensiveness and scope of those activities to try and draw those more cohesively together and across the multiple species.
Thank you.
Just one more follow-up, if I could.
Yes, Senator Ingberg.
There may be something we can stop from coming into Minnesota, and that's the wild boar. What's your research on that, or what are you hearing about that? I've had many constituents call those in the hunting and fishing community talking about do not allow those animals in Minnesota because they're devastating. Now, they're certainly a sport. You see it on TV, as my wife calls it, the Whispering Channel, where all the hunters sit in their boxes and whisper back and forth before they kill their critters. She just rolls her eyes and says, we're on the Whispering Channel again here. But is there any reports of that? I know they're very close, but I know that is actually something we can keep out of the state. And I know the Department of – I want to help me with this – Department of Ag, or is it who else? That you have to have a very stringent permit to even bring one into the state for display. But is there any report of that? Because that definitely is an invasive species that we can do something about.
Okay. Any answer?
You know?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Ingebrigtsen, my understanding is they are right across the border in Wisconsin, and so it's hard to believe that a few haven't made it over. I think that the one good thing about the feral boars and pigs is that there is a lot of experience in other parts of the United States. We also know that they can have devastating impacts as well. And so I think one of the things that this center could do, for example, is get together a very sort of a quick evaluation team, bring in a few people who have done this work where they have sort of done some eradication and develop a strategy for Minnesota. And it has a lot to do with detection. Early detection is really the key, and there's a sort of a research piece to that. What's the most effective way to do that detection? And so I think that's the kind of thing that we haven't had the capacity to do yet in the state, is sort of get these sort of teams together, expert teams together. There's a number of species in addition to feral pigs, including common reed, which is a massive problem in some other states, where we should get some, you know, some real kind of a core group together, come up with a few research strategies so we can effectively do research and get a good return on the investment.
Okay. Senator Dietzett?
I'm okay.
Oh, you're okay. Senator Weber.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just mentioning I could sort of envision a new reality show with Senator Ingebrigtsen sort of patrolling the east border.
And would that be another whispering whispering show, too?
And Senator, Mr. Chair, I know that Senator Dibble had a bill that was heard the other day. It was about another terrestrial invasive species, is the cattails. It's just one of those things that we see all over Minnesota right now. People think, hey, we've got these beautiful cattails that we all grew up with, or I did. You know, I know you're not as old.
Yeah.
But the new ones are.
We're going to eradicate those from Loring Pond.
That's right.
Senator Dibble was bullying them.
There's no management of those. We're going to eradicate those. Yeah, I did that. Yeah, I'm bullying those.
He called it, not me. He said bully. It was a bully bill.
Okay, we shall have order. Okay, let's see. Any other comments or question, or whether Mr. Dave Zumeda want to speak?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Zumeda, you may proceed.
Mr. Chair, committee members, my name is Dave Zumeda. I serve as Executive Director of the Minnesota Forest Resources Council. Council includes 17 diverse interests appointed mainly by the governor, one by the Indian Affairs Council. Council was created by the legislature through the Sustainable Forest Resources Act in 1995. And a core mission of our council is to advise the governor and legislature, as well as public agencies, on sustainable forest policies and practices. Forest policy is my area of expertise. Therefore, my remarks in support of the university's proposed terrestrial invasive species research center focus mainly on the center's prospective role in helping protect Minnesota's rural and urban forests, which cover almost one-third of the state. But I should add the center has an important role that's broader than that, looking at farmlands, prairies, wetlands as well, which is an important reason for support of it, as I'll get to in a minute. I'm testifying on behalf of the Forest Resources Council in support of Senate File 2102. One point I want to make in response to an earlier question, there have been some successes with eradication of these invasive species on a statewide or a more local level. For example, in the Twin Cities, pockets of gypsy moth have been eliminated, and in southeast Minnesota as well, for the past 20 years, that have really helped slow the spread of the gypsy moth. So the key is slowing the spread. You're not going to get rid of the species, but you're going to slow the spread. And Asian long-haired beetle has been eradicated in Chicago, in New York City. Plum pox in the state of Pennsylvania, Douglas fir beetle here in Minnesota. And these are based on information provided to me by Geir Friso, who's the director of the Plant Protection Division with the Department of Agriculture, who's here with us today as well. My council has a longstanding interest in the issue of terrestrial invasive species. In 2007, the legislature charged us with creating a Forest Protection Plan Task Force, and we looked at early detection, appropriate response to invasive forest pests, public education about these pests that threaten rural as well as urban and community forests. Two of the key findings from our report to the legislature in 2008 was, number one, because of global trade and increased travel, new pests threaten the health and survival of many tree and other forest species in rural, suburban, and urban areas across Minnesota. Second, failure to quickly detect and eradicate invasive forest pests cost hundreds of millions of dollars per year in the state, and that's out of the $3 to $4 billion in impacts that Dr. Burr estimated across all types of land in Minnesota. The forest pests cause serious harm to Minnesota's environment and economy, including the $6 to $7 billion forest products economy and the $9 billion tourism economy. Since 2012, the impact of terrestrial invasive species on forest health has been one of my council's top priorities. Council has worked closely with the University of Minnesota, DNR, the Minnesota Department of Agriculture, and relevant federal agencies to heighten awareness and understanding of the economic and ecological impacts of these species. My council support the proposed center at the university for the following reasons. First, the center would serve a lead role on terrestrial invasive species research and education across not only forest lands, but across farmlands, wetlands, and prairies. Forests are interspersed with these other types of lands across the state, from border to border, north to south. It would be a critical integrative role that no single institution is filling today, to the detriment of both our economy and environment. CFANS, as the College of Food, Agriculture, and Natural Resource Sciences, and the proposed center, are uniquely suited to fill this role. Second, the proposed Terrestrial Invasive Species Research Center at the university would be a major step toward improving our collective understanding of which terrestrial invasive species in Minnesota are the most important to control and what the most effective control strategies might be. We spend a lot of money on some species where the results may not be what you really are looking for, and there may be opportunities to spend that money more wisely on other species. The prospective savings from this type of research are very hard to estimate, but they certainly could be in the millions of dollars and perhaps a lot more than that, tens of millions or more. Third, the center would serve as a clearinghouse for research-based information and educational programs on terrestrial invasive species and the risks that their establishment and management pose to the health of our forests, farmlands, and other ecosystems. There's no such information clearinghouse currently. Once again, CFANS and this proposed center would be uniquely suited to fill this role. So that ends my testimony, and I'd be happy to take any questions.
Okay. Any question for Mr. Zometa? Okay. With that, we Senate File 2102 will be layover for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. And I think that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members.
Thank you, Senator Saxall. And we're done. So, okay, so we will adjourn.
What do we have to vote on Wednesday?
Huh?
We have eight bonding bills that have been referred to our committee, but we don't have on the schedule for Wednesday. We have four additional appropriations bills that we're going to look at for Wednesday's meeting.
Bonding bills don't have a deadline, I'm told, so.
Right, but.
Okay, so.
So more than the three we have on our calendar now? You're gonna add, can you add to it somehow, or can we? Is there three on our calendar now?
Got one in.
Set file 2150, set file 2304, set file 2333.
Okay, Senator Thomas, I move to adjourn. Submitting all in any all in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Okay. Meeting's adjourned.
Opposed?
Oh, yeah.
No.